on to one of the subjects that we said we would discuss, that of adhesives.
Are we all done with getting power from one place to another?
Yeah, I think we better give up on energy and power. Talk a lot more about it, but we need to discuss a lot of things. Sometimes we call these things glue. What other names do we use? Stick'em? Let's see if we can figure out how these kind of things work and examine what goes on at the submicroscopic or atomic level. If I take this piece of chalk and I break it in two, you'd think I ought to be able to put it back together, wouldn't you?
No, because we're trained. So.
Now, would someone like to tell me just why it is that I can't put that thing back together like that and have it stay back together? Why not?
Because you broke it.
Yeah, that's the kind of reasons we use in science all the time.
Because the only reason it sticks together in the first place is that it was packed under high pressure and you aren't putting high pressure on it.
I think I'm not.
I guess because it takes a certain temperature to be able to get that.
Because all the little pieces fit into each other, and then when you're broken, you lost some of the pieces.
Is it because
it was the chain stock? I used chalk. I used to be able to put it together that way. Not the same stuff anymore.
They used to have a glue binder, but now they just use pressure.
Won't stick at all. Well, yeah.
Maybe it's going to be because of that. Like you showed the double hill. It takes a certain amount of energy to get over the hill to push the bonds together.
Well, it's more, it's not that sophisticated. It's like was said. What length are atomic bonds anyway? What's the ballpark length of bonds that have that are reasonably strong bonds? Do you remember?
8 angstroms.
That's too long. The average chemical bond is probably somewhere around 1.5 angstroms. What's the wavelength of blue light? 4,000 angstroms. And of red light, 7,000 angstroms. So you see, it's only 2,000th of an angstrom. Now, when you hear of precision, they'll say, we polish this to a flatness of a quarter of a wavelength of light. Have you ever heard that term? They make a telescope mirror, and they say this was polished to a flatness of a quarter of a wavelength of light. Well, we're talking about the shortest wavelength of visible light. What's a quarter of that? Still 1,000 angstroms. What you see is still 500 times greater in distance than the average distance of an atomic bond. So now let's say that before I broke this, there were some atomic bonds and they're bonding the things together on this stuff. And if I break it, what happens is that on the atomic scale, I have distorted everything greatly. That may have looked like a really clean break that I could fit back together real nicely. But on the atomic scale, it wasn't. That's just the jaggedest bunch of mountains there were. And you might say, well, didn't the things break, you know, so that they match? Well, no, they didn't. Because in that bending process, there was a distortion. And on an atomic scale, this could have been bent clear over to there. Everything, even brittle things, will bend. It's just that to our ordinary perception, we'd say it didn't bend. But you get down to the atomic scale, we would now have what are called disparities. I don't even know how to spell it. But I can say it. Is that an A? Disparities.
Is that even true of tight crystalline structures?
Yes. If I took a diamond, even, which has the strongest bonds of any known substance that go through three-dimensional space. There are stronger bonds in a plane, like in a benzene ring, a graphite, but three-dimensional space. You break a diamond, put it back together, it won't stick together.
You mean you can take graphite and pull it along the plane, pull the plane lengthwise in the sky? It's the smoothest, strongest, the bulk most straight.
Yeah, if you could do it, you know. Yeah, see, the bonds are short. By the way, you have heard me say that a double bond is stronger than a single bond is, and a triple bond is stronger than a double bond. You've heard me say that, haven't you? Now, sometimes, without explanation, you may interpret it to mean that this is stronger bond towards chemical attack. That's not what you mean. Towards chemical attack by another substance, such as oxidation by an oxidizing substance. This is weaker than that, is weaker than that. So strength from chemical attack is greatest in a single bond, least here. By strength, we mean consider that bond to be a spring holding two things together. You can't consider it to be the mechanical equivalent of a spring. That's a stronger spring, and it's holding these atoms closer together in this bond than it is in this, but this bond is being held closer together than that. So bond strength does not necessarily mean resistance to chemical attack by another substance. I mention that because in a Chemistry 100 class I teach, I found to my dismay that the students in general thought I was talking about the strength against being resisted by attack by other chemicals. And not, you know, a guy who's been in chemistry for 35 years, everything is so plain and clear to you, it's hard for you to explain it to others. You think you have explained the picture and you really haven't. Well, all right. Now, another thing about these bonds, chemical bonds are like this. If you pull them apart, I'll draw a diagram. Let's see. This is energy in a bond. The chemical bond is, this is increase in energy, and this is distance apart that the atoms are. There's a potential well in here where the thing is stable. And then you get it over this little hill. Actually, this is fairly flat. It's not that steep. You get it out about like that. Well, this is compression of the bond along here. Very hard to compress. Very hard to stretch until you get up to this distance, and then things fade fast. And actually, from here to here, you can take an average law that the strength of a chemical bond, and I'll just use S for a symbol. Oh, it's a bad one. Maybe I better use ST. It's proportional to 1 over r to the 6th power, r being the distance between the two atoms. Now, for those of you who've had any arithmetic, you know that the force holding the things together is falling off really fast at r to the 6th. So if my normal bond distance is 1.5 angstroms, and I get out to 2 angstroms apart, Those atoms aren't pulling each other together at all. So it only takes a little bit of misfit for them not to stick themselves together. Now, in past times, man used to believe that you could polish things good enough that you could get things to stick together. Have you ever heard of Johansson gauge blocks? Any of you ever had anything to do with a machine shop? Johansson gauge blocks are very precisely made blocks of hardened steel that have a certain thickness. Ford pioneered the use of these in America in manufacturing processes. And they come in different thicknesses. so that they become a standard. You can place a micrometer and measure this distance to calibrate a micrometer or something else. And you can stack these gauge blocks up to get various heights. You know how you take different weights and put them on a scale? You have a 1 gram and a half gram and then in tenth grams and hundredths and so on. Well, gauge blocks are the same. So you stack them together to get any length that you want. Now, with gauge blocks, to get them close together, you can see if you're stacking blocks together, if there's any gap in here, you'd be off and wouldn't have a good measurement. Well, now, Johansson gauge blocks give you an accuracy in the millionths of an inch. And to put blocks together, you do what they call ring them together. And ringing means that you put one against the other. I wish I had some, well, I guess the erasers look more like Johansson gauge blocks than chalk. But you consider this to be an extremely well-lapped surface to within a quarter of wavelength of light on both sides. And you take them and you go like this to them. That's called ringing them together. And they stick together. And guys used to think that since they were so flat, that you had got the atoms close enough together that you had reestablished the atomic bond, you see. But now we know that's not true. And if you'd really thought about it, any chemist, this is all developed by mechanical engineers, if a chemist had thought about it, he would have recognized, most chemists are pretty dumb mechanical engineering, so that's why they never thought about it. They didn't even know Johansson gauge blocks existed. But you get more than 1.5 angstroms away, you're not going to have any atomic forces. Now, it is true that there are disparities sticking out there, and they're going to be touching, you see. But the disparities that are touching close enough together to make some atomic bonds again are not going to be very great in number. Furthermore, there's going to be an oxide film on everything that's sticking out, and that's what happens when you ring them together. You scrape off the oxide film, and then you get welding at the asperities. And so that's how come Johansson gauge blocks stick together. You got a question?
Well, if they were getting very many, if you really did establish the atomic bond on a great surface, it would be just like it became part of the steel again.
Yeah, it'd be just like
itself. Two blocks would become one, and
yeah,
you wouldn't be able to break them apart after.
Yeah. Well, you can't get them apart this way. You unring them with Johansson gauge blocks. You sway them to the side like that. Now, there's so many places we could jump in to start talking about adhesives. I don't quite know what's best. Let me see what we should do now. We're talking about breaking things in two. The thing that I want you to recognize is that if you break something in two, you just cannot fit them back well enough together to get a bond. Okay.
What about these buildings that are put together completely without any mortar?
Those blocks are heavy enough that the friction is high, that they're not going to slip anyplace. It's just friction. As a matter of fact, nowadays with friction, you know, certain things have certain coefficients of friction. It's a welding and unwelding as you go along. They know that nowadays. These asperities, just like a bunch of mountains and valleys, they go along and they weld and unweld and weld and unweld as you drag things across each other. And that's what friction is. And some things have low friction and some things have high friction. But there's no such thing as a perfect surface like you would want on an atomic scale that in physical things that man deals with. Jeff?
Well, that means that everything that's ever stuck together, no matter how it's stuck together, is stuck together by wedging.
Something in between them.
No, but I mean it's by electronic bonds, except for when you wedge two things together, you know, like it's going to be because of electronic bonds, like glue or tie rope, it's going to be an electronic.
Yeah, well now, they have what is called friction welding. And spark plug valves. Valves for trucks, big trucks, are usually put together by friction welding. They have the head of the valve, which looks something like that, which has to be an alloy that will withstand a very high temperature. It'll be an expensive material. The stem of the valve does not need to withstand a high temperature. They make that, so it's made out of just a good grade of steel. This is stuck to that part by friction welding. What they do, they chuck this up in a lathe and it spins with rapid rotation, spinning this way rapidly, and you just jam the stem with force up against that other. And as it spins around, it immediately becomes red hot. It's an amazing thing to watch. And spins around, becomes red hot, and makes what they call a friction weld. But you see, as that rotates, it's rubbing oxide coat and everything off from the steel and exposing bare steel. And before it can get recoated with oxide, the disparities have welded together enough that, and things get real hot, it gets red hot. And you sort of get a weld. And it's a good weld. That's a good way to do it.
What about when you center diamond? Is it almost the same sort of thing? Are you getting a...
Yeah, you have... the diamond is so darn resistant to compression that it's the sharp edges that are welding together in the main. Speaking of welding, welding is in a sense a form of gluing. Blacksmith welding. See, modern electric arc welding and acetylene torch welding didn't exist before, well, I don't know when, maybe 1900. Prior to 1900, any welding you did on steel had to be a blacksmith weld. And what you would do is heat the steel in a forge red hot, say you wanted to join this piece to this piece, heat them both red hot, lay them on the anvil, and then pound them. Turn it over, rotate, just pound. Well, in the pounding process, and you also try to stretch, you remove oxide film from the surfaces and you can get straight down to an atom to atom bond. Now let's talk about, at high temperature, atoms you see are more mobile too. Steel red hot is easier to weld than welding steel cold. In fact, I don't know that you can do it cold. It has to be heated enough that atoms can move and diffuse around. Let's speak of a surface. The surface of a substance is different than the interior of the substance. Let's just make up some kind of a magical material and say that we have some kind of stuff that made four bonds like that. I'll run a bunch of lines along here. This is a crystalline substance. And at the center of each intersection of these lines is an atom. Makes four bonds. Well, see, an atom down in here, great, it's bonded up there and down to there and over there and likewise. Covalent bonds. But now we come to the edge of the material. Here's a bond hanging out here, you see. And no more metal or whatever it is down here to bond to. If we have it in the most perfect vacuum that man can create, there will still be atoms of nitrogen and oxygen or whatever else is in the atmosphere that we tried to pump out present. You just can't get rid of everything. And oxygen atoms will come down here. And since oxygen likes to make two bonds, the thing is make a couple there and a couple there, a couple there. Or any one of a dozen other things normally present in most atmospheres will come down and bond to that surface. Oxygen is the common material bonded to most surfaces. So you see, the surface here is different than the rest of the material. Now, other things can also take place. It'll try to pick up oxygen or other things, but in addition, it'll just make more bonds to itself where it can. So that the surface, the very outer atom of a material, is always different than the interior. And there is a whole chemistry called the chemistry of surfaces. And after you had gone through your PhD in chemistry, then you could branch out and be a surface chemist and spend a couple of years as a postdoc just trying to learn about that field. A vast field, just the chemistry of a surface, because any surface is different than an interior of a substance. Can you see that that would be the case? So then you see, if I bring up another surface here of the same material and try to make it mate perfectly with what was before, even if I could do that, you see the surface now is different. So that's another reason I wouldn't get a bond.
There are now some oxygen atoms on the surface. There are now some bonding back in. More bonds here than there are there. And there literally is a skin on any surface, be it a liquid or be it a solid. There is some kind of a skin on that material, even though there were not other atoms there. There would still be a skin and a surface energy for that surface that is a higher energy than the energy down within the material.
Can you hold the skin of water?
Yeah.
Okay. Water, what bonds together by hydrogen bond on the molecules.
Yeah.
What's it like on the surface? Why do you get that old skin where you can build up a certain water tension enough to leave it cold, say, needle on top, you can drop a needle on top of a glass of water, and it'll sit there on top of the water tension?
Well, this skin, this phenomenon of the higher energy at the surface than down inside is called surface tension. And solids, it's not only liquids that have surface tension. Solids also have it. It's just easier to observe that it is there on liquids, and it's easier to measure the strength of that skin on the surface of a liquid. We call that surface tension. Grant, did you want to say something?
I got interested in this, and I...
All right, now let's go on from here.
Nothing on my...
For glues. If I take two reasonably flat surfaces, and I just moisten the surface in between with oil or water or anything else, and try to pull them apart, you'll find that it's much more difficult to pull them apart than it was if there was nothing there. If there's just air there, they come apart easily. But put any liquid in there, that liquid will serve as a glue for a straight pull. But something like water or alcohol, I can slide. I was going to get some samples and demonstrate all these things to you, but three wheels showed up this morning and I've been tied up with them all afternoon, and two more showed up this afternoon. I'm going to run and have to take care of this afternoon. But maybe you can get the picture anyway. Isn't it in your experience, have you ever had two real flat things like a piece of glass, and you can't pull them apart that way if there's some liquid in between, but you can slide them like that, okay?
With contact lenses.
Or lay that way? But you can slide it off.
Yeah, you slide it off the top. Bottom, and it slides down the side of the face when I turn all of it.
I don't know why you girls go with contact lenses. Some guys do.
Some of those suction arrows, you know.
Well, my daughters, I don't know whether all women are that way or not, but you know, they want a place to put them, so they put them in their cheeks, you know. You do that?
You can get a lot better vision with contacts. I have 20/10 vision with contacts, and I have about 20/25 glasses.
And I always lose them. I have 5 daughters. Number of contact lenses I bought, I hate the number. Lose them.
That's what you should have gotten in the meeting instead of that.
Oh, I'm down all day.
3 miles in contact lenses.
Well, all right, now, there are some theories on adhesion. They're not too good, but I think they do give us some insights into it. Most theories in science are really not all that good. They're better in some areas than others. But in the field of adhesion, there is still a lot of art. There's a lot of art in all science, and we didn't used to be so specific. We'd have colleges of arts and science, recognizing that there was science to art and there was art to science, but now we sort of cut them off as separate entities. But there is still a lot of art in science, and there's particularly a lot of art in the field of adhesion. But we do think we have a kind of an understanding of what this adhesion is about. Guys have measured what they think is the distance at which adhesion can take place. Chemical bonds, like 70 feet, are about 1.5, maybe on up to 3 angstroms. Between the graphite layers is 3 angstroms, and graphite is extremely weak in that one direction because of this long bond length. Well, the adhesive bond, which can take place simply by putting a liquid in here. Now, a liquid in there, you see, a liquid can flow into all the little valleys, even though they're only atomic size. Something like water is not too big a molecule. There are 3 atoms in the thing. And of course, it's bigger than just one single atom. But it's small enough that it can flow down into all the submicroscopic cracks and crevices. And it does not form a true chemical bond, but it forms what they sometimes call an adhesive bond. And the length of those bonds is beginning at about 3 angstroms. I got some notes somewhere. Let's see. In the range of 3 to 10, I figure. 3 to 10 angstroms, you can have adhesive bonding. Guys have done that by studying things with electron microscopes. We can get down to, they can make a glue line and carefully saw the thing off, and then with an electron microscope go in there and see what things look like. And they've come to the conclusion. Chemical bond, you see, maybe down as low as 1.2 angstroms, but on up to maybe 3. Well, taking where the chemical bond leaves off and going off to about 10 angstroms, you can have a much weaker bond called an adhesive bond. You can get that bond by putting any liquid in here, doesn't matter what, water, alcohol, spit, whatever you want.
What is an adhesive bond?
Well, what's a chemical bond?
A couple of
Van der Waal forces, I guess, which can operate over a fairly long range. But these kind of bonds, the force between the atoms is proportional to 1 over the distance apart to the 7th power. You see, falling off even more rapidly than in the case of atomic bonds.
This is the adhesive bond here?
Yeah. Clayton.
So if we had 2 pieces of pure iron with water in between them, that we were going to bonding together just, say, by water, then there would be iron bonding to the water molecule?
Not a chemical bond. You couldn't consider it in the way of a chemical bond at all. It would be a non-directional bond. It's a force field of some kind induced by the action of the electrons at long range. Could have thought of it was
induced by the
spacers. They were discussing this. Now, is that induced by the rotation of the electrons around the nucleus, or the spin of the electrons themselves?
Well, who knows? But it's electronic motion that induces charges in atoms that are in the distance of 3 to 10 angstroms apart. We generally refer to all those kind of bonds as Van der Waals bonds because we don't know much about them except they're long-range forces of not much strength compared to true atomic bonds. Thought to be due to electronic motions. The fact that an electron carries a charge and can induce a current when it's in motion in some other substance is not too far away.
Now, this is completely different from hydrogen bonding, right?
Well, not all that different. Atomic bonding is also due to electrons and their motions and their charge, and so is hydrogen bonds. But we classify 3 kinds of bonds, and well, more than that. We have electrostatic bonds. We have covalent bonds, but they are in the same ballpark strength-wise. True bonds between things have energies above 5 kilocalories, generally in the range of 50 kilocalories. Then you go to hydrogen bonds, which is an induced kind of bond between an electronegative element such as oxygen or fluorine and hydrogen, which have bond strengths of about 5 kilocalories. And then you have bonds that are still weaker, maybe less than a kilocalorie, and which we classify roughly as Van der Waals bonds, or bonds due to Van der Waals forces. All right, now, the trouble with just putting any liquid in here, if the surfaces are relatively smooth, and we put any liquid in there, you do have a good adhesive bond for a straight pull. But if the liquid is a small molecule, like water, then the shearing action is easy. These just sort of roll around, and you just roll one surface right off the other in the sliding action, you see. So if you don't want sliding action, you can improve the bond by putting something in there that has a higher viscosity than water. So you put something in like honey. And you put honey in, the bond this way is really no better, but the bond this way is better because honey contains long snake-like molecules, polysaccharides, and you don't just roll those around like a rock or a ball bearing. They get caught in each other and have to snake around to get out of the way, and so you have what is called viscosity. All viscous substances, from cold tar to things like honey, contain long molecules. That's a characteristic of a viscous substance. If you have anything that's viscous, it means long molecules are present. Okay?
Well, like when you say something's sticky, you mean water is just as sticky to pull apart as honey, or?
Well, stickiness is a word that I think we associate with other kinds of things. Stickiness means that when you pull things apart, you get a string of something, you know, forms a fiber. That doesn't happen with water. But yes, between flat surfaces, plain old water, if they're good and flat, within a quarter wavelength of light, for example, and you pull straight like that, it's strong. It's strong. But you can shift it off this because it's a small molecule that, like I say, it's like a pretty good ball bearing, just rolls along. They get out of the way of each other readily. Okay, let's see. This is my notes again. Well, that's something else. All right, now let's get back to some other ideas. Liquids have a phenomena of surface tension, which we have already mentioned. If I take a surface and put a drop of a liquid on it, sometimes, depending on this surface and depending on that liquid, the drop will stand up sort of like a ball. In other instances, it may be sort of like that. In some instances, it will essentially spread out completely. That phenomenon we call wettability. Wettability.
So you have something to make water wet.
Yeah. When you add a detergent to water, it louses up the skin on water and it flattens out like that. It has a lower surface tension. That's another function of a detergent that aids in the washing of clothes. The water will spread because the detergent has the property of lowering the surface tension of the water. Skin doesn't form on the waters that naturally would. Now, the wettability depends on the properties of this solid surface on which you place the drop and the properties of the liquid. Let me draw that again. There's a phenomenon we call a contact angle. You draw a tangent to this thing,
right where it's touching there. You see, if we have one that's out like this, we'll have a pretty steep angle. Low angle, I guess, would be better with respect to this horizontal. Well, the steeper that angle, the higher the surface tension of this material. Now look, considering that there's vapor out here, in this region, I better get the drawing. I draw this a little differently. Sometimes it'll look just like a haystack, sort of like that. This angle, theta, we can call this the surface tension. Surface tension is given by the Greek lowercase letter gamma. Between the liquid and its vapor, you see up above this, would be the vapor of the liquid. So this is surface tension between the liquid and its vapor. And along this way, there is a surface tension between the solid and the vapor, but inside there is a surface tension between the liquid and the solid. And all of those forces are the thing that result in the way this stands up. So you're not just dealing with the surface tension alone between the liquid and the solid, but you have a surface tension between the solid and the vapor, and between the liquid and its vapor. Or if it's some other vapor that's out here other than the vapor of the liquid, it would be that vapor. Now, sometimes these two are not important, but there are cases where they are important. Now, what kind of a surface is a non-wettable surface in your experience? Can you name me just one from everyday life?
Wax.
Okay, if you polish your car real good and then it rains, you notice how the drops really stand up there. And then your car gets dirty and all wax gets washed off, then the water lays down flat. It's not up in a ball. Now, one of the surfaces that does that the best is Teflon. Yeah. The solid surface tension, if you can think of such an abstract subject in your mind, is very low for Teflon. I have some figures here that I copied out of a book, if I can find them. Well, I guess I only recorded a couple. For liquids. Oh no, this was for solid. Surface tension also determines how much friction you have between two surfaces. The surface tension of solids and liquids, well, of solids, is related to the friction that you have. Now, if you take polyethylene, which is the most common plastic there is on the face of this earth, the clear, transparent stuff that you use for garbage bags and whatnot, it has, if you measure its friction in some kind of units, and I don't know the units, it has about 0.33 for a surface tension. Now, if you chlorinate that thing to make a substance like polyvinylidene chloride, which contains 2 chlorine atoms per monomer unit, then you get a friction between it and itself up around 9. With just one chlorine atom, which is what phonograph records and saran wrap are made out of, just vinyl chloride, then this is down around 75. But if you add fluorine and completely replace all of the hydrogens on the carbon backbone with fluorine, you get clear down to 0.03, which is a phenomenally low coefficient of friction. Okay.
I think that coefficient of friction is taken from, as it be the tangent of the angle at which it would have to be raised and slide along itself under standard gravity.
Is that the definition of coefficient of friction?
That's what I heard once.
Here's the angle for it to slide. Maybe some certain weight on it. Some standard weight of a kilogram or something. It would be an arbitrary definition of some kind.
So sliding on itself?
Sliding on itself. So Teflon to Teflon is low like that, but many other substances also have low friction to Teflon because of its very low surface tension. So you can fry eggs on Teflon and they don't stick, for example. Okay.
When you talk about surface tension now, are you talking, how does that relate to the atomic tension?
It's the strength of the skin.
So in other words, it would be the strength of the bonds in that plane on the surface.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you say they have a low surface tension, that means that they're not very strong bonds?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when, with this up.
So, how does that work? When you fry an egg, it lifts the Teflon off?
Well, the Teflon is strong enough back in itself to hold itself together. Although it's too weak, you know, you have to scrape it with a plastic scraper instead of a metal one, or pretty soon you're digging holes in it. But on the surface, the thing is not very attractive to anything. Doesn't attract other things. Doesn't matter what they are, there's not much attraction for the other stuff.
Does Teflon depend on the oxide coating, or is there something else?
I don't know. Fluorine atoms attached to carbon atoms have that property. If you have a fluorocarbon liquid substance, the bonds between the stuff are real weak. So I would suppose that fluorine, when it's saturated,
here's a carbon atom at the end of the chain, and here are three fluorines on it. And that it sees another carbon, three fluorines. Attraction between it is very low. They tend to be gaseous substances, even though you get lots of carbon atoms in it. More so than hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbons, pure hydrocarbons, so you see, have fairly low coefficient of friction. Well, let's get around to a couple of other ideas. Now, depending on the surface tension of this and the surface tension of that, you will get this, which we say it's very wettable surface. It's easy to wet that surface. Now, one thing that you want to happen when you put some glue on a substance, solid substance, is that it flows into all the crevices very easily. So a first requirement for a good glue would be, one, that it wets things. It doesn't stand up there in a ball, but it flows out and wets things. Well, now, in all engineering problems, that may be good for one property, you see, but maybe bad for another, because wettable things may have weak bonds internally. But you have to compromise on all these things. But you do want some wettability. Okay, a second kind of a thing that you would want. Oh yeah, I've talked about just having a liquid in there. Now, if I could take my honey that was in there as a liquid, you see, I can still slide the things off from each other. It's harder to do it than when I just have water between my solid things. But if I could suddenly make the stuff a solid instead of a liquid, then you see, I wouldn't have this shearing thing if I could make the glue a solid. So what I'd like to do for a second thing in my glue is to be able to turn the liquid that I put in there to a solid. And then a third thing I'd like to have and all of this comes from experience, is that I would like to have some pliability in my glue. If my glue is extremely rigid, when the glue sets up, see, if I start with a liquid, the glue is going to have to set to a solid by some mechanism that I choose. Then, when this sets into a solid, almost all polymeric materials, long chain molecules, as they are cross-linked, are linked into still longer molecules to make them a solid, shrink. They all shrink. So if my glue is sort of rubbery, then in this shrinkage process, I won't break the bond. But there are glues that when they set hard, things just pop apart because there are a lot of stresses induced due to the shrinkage of the glue. So most glue experts consider these three kinds of things in trying to design a glue. Well, let's glue something together like paper. Now, paper is easy to glue because it's porous. If we are gluing porous things, we can get what guys in the glue industry call hooking. Paper, cardboard, and wood, cloth, leather, and many things are easier to glue than, say, gluing steel to steel, or glass to glass, because the materials are porous. You look at paper under a microscope and it would amaze you how porous it is. You only have to look at it under about 10 to 20 power to just see the fibrous porosity of paper. So what you have this mass of fibers, and your glue goes down into those fibers. And if I look at a fiber on end, you see the glue has gone clear around the fiber. And then here's my glue up in here, and then here's another piece of paper up in here, and the glue has hooked around that fiber. That's how the term comes up. So in gluing porous materials, I get a mechanical bond. I actually get a mechanical bond. And people in the glue business, as I mentioned, call that hooking. With solid substances that are not porous, particularly glass and metals, then I have to rely simply on the adhesive bond. You want the bond to be thin, as a rule. These attractive forces that come into play in the 3 to 10 angstrom range. A glue that does not shrink too much so that there's a popping off of the things on each side.